At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at Central Orlando Group's Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscience meeting. My name's Tim, and I am an alcoholic. I spent 34 years doing it my way, and the end result of all of that was the smell of burnt house. And I was sitting in the house that I had burnt down, and looking at my last drink, and I had no hope. And I cried out for help, and because I didn't know what else to do, and they sent me here. And I followed a few simple suggestions ever begrudgingly, and you know, today I'm able to walk through this life one day at a time without a drink. Thanks. Okay. Now it's getting ready to get good, so buckle your seatbelts. The group has asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing, and not to ask if anybody can be a sponsor until after the speaker speaks. So I'm not going to do that now. Okay. Let me tell you just a little bit about the speaker tonight. I used to go to a lot of evening meetings. I used to go to a lot of noontime meetings, and I used to look at my shoelaces most of the time, no matter which meeting I was in. And I did not know the name of the voice I was hearing, but I was told by my sponsor to listen to the good and to leave the rest. And ladies and gentlemen, tonight you will be entertained and hopefully spiritually moved by one of my favorite voices of good. Everybody, please welcome Suzanne.
Oh, there's no damn place to put this water. I promise I won't swear much. Hi everyone, my name is Suzanne and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
it's an honor to be here tonight and to be sober. What a surprise. My sobriety date is August 18th of 1987. I hit the doors at 23. So if you want to add that up, yes, I am 48 years old. Because I would do that too when someone would put their sobriety date out there. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I have a home group. And I work with others, and I try to incorporate this program into my life. It has been a growing year for me, and I've got to tell you that without my sobriety, I really don't know where I would be tonight, and without the love and support of the folks in this room. You know, when I first got here, my only hope was I just didn't want to wake up drunk anymore. I didn't want to have pee in my bed anymore. I didn't want to have a drink before I got out of bed anymore. And I got that, you know. But I've gotten a lot more than just that. And I've gotten a new life. I didn't get my old life back, thank God. I got a new life. And it's through the help of you people and a God of my understanding. I hold a 30-year medallion in my pocket tonight. My sponsor passed away 2 weeks ago. And she would have 30 years, and she was 80 years old, and she was the baddest ass chick I knew. She was a tough broad with the most loving spirit, and I feel like I've been granted a gift to have walked with her for the last couple of years. I knew her 17 years, but boy, we were tight as thieves for the last 4 years, and I feel very honored to be here tonight in her memory, because she had the gift of carrying the message to me, and I pray that God works through me tonight to carry the message to you. So, where did it begin? Well, I am the youngest of seven children, good Catholic family. That meant we always had a little wine, always had a nice alcohol cabinet in the house. My dad was a jazz musician, so on Sundays we always had good music blowing through the house. And, you know, it was, I think, a fairly normal childhood. You know, we, this time of year always brings back fond memories, you know, of growing up. We had a group of cousins that we were really tight with, and we were always together during Christmas and the holidays. We were at their house or they were at our house, and it was loud and it was noisy and there was drinking and it was just crazy. And I was thinking about my first Christmas experience as a kid, and when did I outgrow Santa Claus? And it was, I think, about 6 years old when I finally was told to go to bed after we had opened the gifts, and I heard noise out in the kitchen, and like a good nosy kid like I was and still am, I peeked down the hallway and I saw Santa Claus pulling off his beard and taking a toke of a drink, and that's where Santa Claus went out the window. And, you know, that's kind of how my drinking went, I think. You know, I had a great fondness for drink. I started drinking at 13 years old. I've got to tell you that at 9 years old, there was a new member brought into the family, and within 2 years, I was molested. And it went on for many, many years. And I'd like to tell you that that's the reason I drank. I drank because I was a very insecure person. I always felt a little bit odd, like the odd duck in the room. I never really felt connected to the family that I grew up with. And it's not because of no love, because there was plenty of love to go around. It's just because inside of me there was a big gaping hole and nothing could fill it. And I'd love to tell you that alcohol did, and it did for maybe a minute, but it turned on me pretty quickly. You know, and I know alcohol was important because I remember my first drink more than I remember my first kiss, so that should tell you something. You know, it had a slight significant role in my life. I was 13 years old. We were living in Montreal at this time. We had moved at this point 3 or 4 times, so we were always moving. You know, I was always leaving one set of friends, getting very uncomfortable, moving to a new town, new friends, and I've got to tell you, I just felt so inadequate as a human with those types of experiences. But had you met me, you would have thought I had it pulled together because I was a good actor and sometimes still can be. And here I am trying to fit into that group of friends, and I found the drinking friends, and we were going to go skiing for the first time. Well, for me. Of course, I told them I was pretty good at skiing. Just moved from Florida to Canada, not much skiing down here. And, you know, here I was with this group of friends, and we were on the top of the Laurentian Mountains, and they handed me a little flask and took a toke on that thing, and son of a gun, I started growing. I felt like 6 feet tall. I felt like Marilyn Monroe, and, you know, felt like I had owned the world by you-know-what, and boy, I was just feeling good, and I kept the bottle for the rest of the day. Didn't do much skiing, did a lot of drinking, and boy, did it feel good. And I got to tell you, the next day when I woke up and I was puking in my shoes and feeling like horse crap, within an hour I was thinking about another drink, and I remember it fondly. And, you know, that's where it began. I love drinking. I'm not going to stand here and tell you I didn't like drinking, because I certainly did like drinking. And I didn't drink for the taste like the book talks about. I drank for the effect. Because booze did for me what religion couldn't do for me, what my parents couldn't do for me. Nothing. You know, booze did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And it made me feel complete. And I chased that for 10 years. My drinking went downhill pretty quick. I'm always amazed when someone walks in here and they're in their 50s or 60s and they're finally getting here. I'm like, son of a gun. Boy, howdy, how'd you do it, you know? I don't know. Maybe God just wanted me here quicker than most. But, you know, here I am. I'm chasing that drink and somehow make it through high school by the skin of my teeth. And that's another great story. You know, so here I am. I graduate high school, and I ask if I could have a couple friends over for a little party. Now, my parents knew something wasn't right with me. They never wanted to say maybe it was the drinking, but they were trying to figure things out. I had been taken to psychologists and psychiatrists, and let's look at the eating disorder, and let's look at your behavior, but let's not talk about that drinking now. And so here we have this little party, and 80 kids from school show up. and my poor parents are stuck there. And this is back in the 80s, so there was drinks, of course. And, you know, I take off. Have a good time. I go to another party. You know, my mom is still pissed about that one. Entertaining 80 kids for my graduation party. I just took off. See you later. And she still, I think, sometimes gets a little ticked about that. And, you know, that's how I was. I never felt comfortable in one place. If I was here, I wanted to be there. You know, that's just how it was. And, you know, most of the kids had big plans after high school. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I decided maybe it'd be nice to become a nun. Like I had the material to be a nun. And so here I am, packed up, bag packed, suitcase, Bible, clothes, couple bottles, just in case, rosary beads, because, you know, I'm thinking maybe I really want to become a nun. And I go up to Boston. And I go stay at this little rectory in Dorchester, Mass., which is a pretty tough end of town. Holy cow. Didn't know it because I was half in the bag, you know. I drank before we'd go out and go serve the community, and I'd drink when I'd get home in my little room, and I realized pretty quickly I didn't think I was nun material. So soon I went back home, and God love my parents, you know. My mom was she just never could figure me out. I was going to be an actor one day, and I'd be a writer the next day, and maybe I'll become a business person. They couldn't keep up with me, neither could I. So I went to college. I went for a year of college. At the end of the year, they sent my parents a letter saying thank you for the tuition, but she's not invited back. I just wasn't really, you know, into schooling. It's hard to be into schooling when you're drinking a lot. So I do what any good person does. I went to a tech school, got out, went into the medical industry for a little bit, and eventually found my way into sales, and boy, that was a great job for a drunk, you know. I always had two briefcases in the car. I had one that had paperwork and one that had bottles. And the one that had bottles had a lot more activity than the one with the paperwork. You know, I'd show up, I'd be like their little star. I'd show up and do the deal, and boy, I'd be like all that in a bag of chips, and then I'd just peter out. And, of course, I'd quit before they'd fire me. You know, I remember I had a boss once that gave this one girl and I the credit card to take a couple of clients out. Dumb move. And, you know, the clients had left by 9 o'clock, and we stayed till about 1 o'clock. And I was asked to leave that job pretty soon thereafter. Can't imagine why. You know, I really was baffled by this thing called life. I saw people doing life on life's terms. I saw brothers and sisters getting married and having kids and, you know, going to college. And I just knew something wasn't ticking right inside of me. But I've got to tell you, I didn't think it was the drink, you know. That was my staple. That's what made me feel good about me. I met this guy at a bar, go figure, and he and I became fast friends. You know, we get fast friends in bars. Sometimes fast dates, fast friends. That's where I lived, was at the bar. And, you know, we became good buddies, and he offered me a job in Miami. Well, there's my first geographic cure. You know what? I'd run out of boys. My parents were getting a little fed up with me. I wasn't really an enjoyable company to have around their house. They made that real clear. And, you know, I thought maybe going to Miami would make me better. And so I remember calling my sister going, well, I'm moving to Miami. She's like, well, that's nice. And I'm not going to drink all the way down to Miami. Well, you shouldn't be drinking and driving. Well, all right. Because that was just normal for me. And I remember telling my parents, well, I'm moving to Miami. If you want to put on a little going away party for me, you know, I'd be all good with that. And I remember my mom looking at me with disgust. You know, that was a pretty typical look I'd get. And she said, you know what? We're leaving that weekend that you're packing because we just can't deal with this. And my only prayer is that I don't see you in a body bag one day. That's how my drinking had progressed. You know, I was drinking every day. I was probably 90 pounds. I was getting very ill. You know, I was the girl that would be at a party and look all cute for about a minute, and then I'd be puking in the corner to go drink some more. And the abnormal became normal for me. You know, I was talking to someone before the meeting, and, you know, I was the girl you didn't want to be hanging around, especially if you were another girl and you had a man, because my behavior was not always predictable nor respectable. And I just, you know, I did that because I didn't want to have to deal with another human being. You know, I didn't want to have to get close to you. I get close to you, I'm running. And I think about that today because from my high school year, I have one friend that I stay in contact with. And, you know, none from the college years. I wouldn't even know them if I saw them, I guess, because I was half in the bag. But it just shows you my inability to form any true partnership with another person. I think the only reason why I know my family today is because we're blood, because I really was despicable to them. And I think about the time I drove to my sister's house and almost ran over her neighbor and their dog and drove over their lawn to get to my sister's lawn to find her, you know, driveway. And I remember her saying, "You're not welcome back here anymore. Our neighbors don't like you." Well, why not, you know? What's the big deal? I had no clue I was about to hit the dog or the lady, you know? Especially when I lived at my parents' house and I'd pull into the house next door and I'd put my key in there. Son of a gun, what the heck? It wasn't my house. Start knocking. "Let me in." "Well, hi, you're at the wrong house." "Okay." Back the car out, pull it into the next driveway. That's how I was. I was a little out there. And so, you know, I moved to Miami, and the good actor shows up. You know, I jump into that job, and I try to just, you know, God, they're going to love me. And within a very short while, they knew something wasn't right with her, because as they were pulling into work in the morning, I would still be sleeping in my car from the night before because I had too many drinks in the office to get in the car to drive home. So I would just sleep in Hialeah, Florida, in my car. And then I would realize when I'd wake up that I was still in my car. Well, no need going home. Fluff that 80s hairdo up, you know, get that stuff going and walk in like no one would notice I'm wearing the same shit from yesterday. Yes, I thought I was pulling one on them, you know. I was the girl with the big pocketbook. You know, we have big pocketbooks when we're drinking, not because we have any crap or money in there, but we have a lot of little bottles in there. And, you know, there was a guy that I worked with that said, "I want to talk to you." I said, "Okay, come see me." I go see him, and he gives me a number, and I'm thinking, cha-ching, ching, money. You know, I'm in sales. What's the number? Gets you to your next deal. Well, I go up to my office. I dial the phone. The club. The club. Alcoholics Anonymous. What in the hell? That was my second introduction to AA, and I'll just tell you, my dad was a professional, set me up with boys kind of guy, because I think he really wanted to marry my ass off. And he met a nice Catholic boy, and little did he know that this guy was in AA and had been sober for many years. And by our third date, this guy took me to an AA meeting. I wonder why. And that was my introduction to AA. I sat in here for about a half an hour and I thought, "Them poor son, sorry son of a guns." And I stood up in the middle of the meeting. I said, "Look, I'm not a, you know, an alcoholic. I'll be at the bar next door. So when you're done, come get me." And that didn't last very long. We actually made amends to each other when I finally got sober. So it's kind of funny how that works. But here I am, second introduction to AA. There would be a third one, because I didn't call AA at that point. You know, I kept the number, but I didn't call it. But I was drinking with this guy that I was hanging with, and at a very cheesy ass bar in Miami. You know, we start at the nice bars when we first start drinking. I used to go to the Marriott and get all dolled up, you know, look all cute, do the 80s dance. And by the end of my drinking, you know, I was at the dive bar, you know, with the bar stools that have the rips all in them. Kind of get bit by the chair, and there's that distinct smell of just funk. Yes. It's like a combination of everything, and so here I'm sitting in this very unique bar, as I like to call it, with this older person drinking, and he said, you know, A, it didn't work for me, but I think it could work for you. Bastard. Well, that didn't last long either. But, you know, it's kind of funny how God works. I was the girl that lived upstairs in this very cheesy little apartment. I had had a really nice apartment when I first moved to Miami because it's all about looking good, right? I had a nice apartment on the golf course. Never had sticks. I don't even know how to play golf. And had no furniture, blow-up bed, lawn furniture. Because, you know, I was waiting for the good stuff to come along, which never did. And middle of the night, my brother helped me move out because, obviously, you know, rent, drinking. Drinking. Let's move to something quaint. A dump. So I moved to this quaint place, and my drinking got so bad at the end that I would move furniture around at 2 in the morning. I would get very nervous that people were coming to get me. I'm not really sure, even to this day, who those people were, but boy, I was just a little bit paranoid schizo. Keep the lights on, you know. I mean, my apartment building was like where that blue wall was to where I am, and the people across the way would yell out, turn off your freaking light. Ah, shut up. I'd have the lights on, furniture moving around. It was insane. You know, I had been dating someone at that point that was on the DUI task force in Miami. I really chose some great people. And they actually left. You know, they said, well, they just could not handle my insanity anymore. And the family at this point had pretty much stopped connecting. And so I was alone. I was, you know, 22 at this point, and I was just desperately alone. And I would drive through the streets of Coral Gable looking around at those nicer homes, and I'd drive real slow and look in those windows and think, God, what in the hell is wrong with me? Why can't I have that? You know, I was just insane. I did call that number, you know, eventually. I come to find out, I thought it was very unique when I was calling the day I called, but I called to get the books, you know, of AA, and I called and they answered, and I'm like, yes, I'm calling for a friend of mine who's not well, and we need to get the textbooks, and how do we get them? And they're like, oh, come visit us. Textbooks, yeah, what did I know? And I don't know what I thought that was. I thought maybe a crash course in how to get better, but I knew at this point that, you know, something was wrong, and I knew my drinking had escalated, and you know, I was living that insane life, and I was turning into that aunt my dad would talk about, who was the alcoholic who died last year, and still drunk, you know, and that's what he saw in me, his sister. So, you know, I went to the clubhouse in the Gables, and I've got to tell you that I went in, spoke with them. I remember looking at these people. They were smiling. They were joking around. The hell is wrong with them, you know? I can't tell you the last time I heard good laughter. Even at those bars, that laughter was so fake now that I think about it. And, you know, I went, and I told them I had a party that night, and I would be back. And I eventually did show up in a blackout. 3 days after that blackout, I guess I was at another meeting, and I met my neighbors who lived below me. And they were so grateful that I was in the room of AA. Thank you, Lord. She's not going to move her furniture around, we pray. Amen. And they were very excited to see me. You know, it's funny. I went to the rooms for a year, and I kept drinking. So whenever I see a good drunk person walk into the rooms of AA today, it fills my heart with joy, because I know there's hope. Because for a drunk like me to be standing here tonight on a Saturday night, 8:30, without a drink, no drink in my pocketbook, that is a God thing. And that is only the result of coming to the rooms and finally getting a connection to a God and surrendering to the principles and to the process. My last drunk was, you know, one of those things where it was inevitable. I was really mayhem for you folks. I was the girl that would show up and kind of bounce from one car to another to find my little parking space. And I would drop bottles in the bathroom, and I would get up to pick up Chip up to say I was getting my 9 months or my 6 months, and then I'd switch it out for, oh, you know, white Chip. Because I guess I did drink last night, kind of thing. And I really wanted what you had. You know, what I didn't get is that you guys were actually doing some work, and I was just yapping my gums at a meeting and staying closed for some weird apparent reason. Now, I kept going to the bars, but I kept coming to AA. So I have to believe something stuck. And, you know, my last drunk, I had a nice fight with a Marine. I lost. I was thrown out of a car. I was not very graceful and fell into a couple tables at a bar in Miami. I don't remember much other than I came to in a hospital, and I was told that 10 people from AA had waited all night for me. Tell me this thing doesn't work. Even for a drunk like me, they were waiting. That's the power of AA. I don't know what happened in that hospital that morning, but I knew I was done. And I've got to tell you, I used to make, you know, pledges and vows. I still have a book that I wrote in when I was drinking. Kind of, you know, you can see the writing was drinking writing, you know, how it goes up and down. And I would write about wanting to have what those people have. And, you know, I guess I just thought I was hopeless. I didn't have enough courage to put a gun to me, but I sure was putting the bottle to my lips. But I knew that morning when I came to that I was done. As this lady, Roxanne, used to say, the jig was up. And the doctor looked at me and she said, I've got to tell you something, that if you ever pick up a drink again for someone like you, you will be in a body bag. I heard that one before. I don't know what she said to me that morning that hit, but I knew my heart was finally open just a smidge. And I realized I was finished. I went back to my apartment. They cleaned me up. My parents and I got on the phone together. My mom had been awoken at 3 in the morning. That's when they found me outside of an AA clubhouse, dying on my vomit, and take me to the hospital. And she started praying, so I believe my mother, the good Catholic woman with those beads, she was working them. And I just know the power of prayer, so who knows. They invited me home. They hadn't invited me home in a long time. But they invited me home and they said, you are welcome to come home under one condition. If you ever pick up a drink in our house, or you pick up a drink, we're done with you. My mother had finally learned tough love. She was going to meet with an Al-Anon lady. She became a professional black belt with rosary beads, so that's scary, isn't it? And so 3 days later, I had my car packed up with everything. Everything else was left. All my furniture I left in my apartment. I drove to a hotel room because at this point, I wasn't working. I thought I had quit. A year later, I would eventually find out my ass was fired. Shows you how much my drinking was going on. I detoxed in the hotel room, and I made my way to Lakeland, Florida. And that's where my sobriety began. You know, so here I am, a couple days out of a drunk, shaken like a you-know-what, scared, first time sober since 13. I go to a meeting. I wear my cheapest burnt suit because, you know, as an alcoholic woman smoking and drinking, your suit seems to get little burn marks in it a lot. But I put it on because I wanted to look good. I had the pager, which tells you how long ago it was. No iPhones back then, a beeper. Tapped my hip. Stolen from my last job. Not working, but it looked good, like I was important. They asked for newcomers? No, I ain't raising my hand. Visitors? Yes, I'm here from Miami. Jeez. Why don't you come up and share? Well, of course. So I go up, and in 10 minutes they realize, this may not be the right speaker for tonight. They thanked me, and they quickly pushed me back to my little chair. After the meeting, this guy with a little beanie-ass hat came up to me, cigar sticking out to here. He said, come on, I want you to meet someone. I said, well, I'd love to meet them. I think you'd be good for them. Well, thank you. No ego here. He said, yeah, she needs a good sick one to work with. I didn't have the luxury of picking my first sponsor, which I think is a great gift from God for me, because this lady showed up exactly right on time. She lived four blocks from my parents' house. And she very quickly said, you will not... Do you want to? You will be at my house tomorrow night. You will have a book with you, and we will start working through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will be going to meetings every day, and if you have an issue with that, get someone else. Okay. I guess I'll be at your house tomorrow night for dinner. And for a year, I went to her house almost every damn night, and this woman took me through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am grateful. I'm grateful for tough sponsorship. I'm grateful for the people that were in her circle. Old Pappy, who looked like George Burns, who just, you know, kind of always took me under his wing and called me kid. You know, the mean lady, there's always one good mean lady that I now know she loved me, but she was mean to me, who would always tell me to shut up, sit down, stop moving in your chair, stop picking your fingernails, you don't need another cup of coffee. Oh, God, gee whiz, give me a drink. And I mean, she drove me nuts, but my sponsor taught me about getting into action, and I believe that today has sustained me, and it is about those lessons I learned when I first got here that still work today. I've got to tell you, I thought there was a magical handshake here, there was some type of magic here, I maybe thought there was a higher... you know, club level here. But it was about one drunk working with another drunk. And I think back to those days when I sat there with this lady across her little kitchen counter, and we would talk about our stories working with others. And she would tell me about her story of drinking, and I talked to her about my story of drinking. And we had decided that maybe I was good with step one. And then we went through, what do I believe? Well, I'm not really sure what I believe. Well, that's good. But she gave me enough rope, because I've got to tell you, when I was real afraid about not getting this God thing, I kept hearing you talking about this God thing in meetings, finding that power of something greater than you. Oh, my God. I went to a synagogue. I went and got dipped, dunked. I don't know. I felt like a dog going to the vet, you know, looking for God. Ooh, where the hell is God? And I was like, you know, the Wizard of Oz, here I come. You know, looking. And seriously, I was looking, because I just, you know, I knew I had that taste still in my mouth of what it was like to be that drunk girl. And I really didn't want to be there anymore. And I was desperate to do whatever you told me to do to get this thing. And I remember going to her house one night, and I said, you know what, I think I'm screwed. I can't find God. And I don't know what to do. And she's like, oh, finally. That's the best thing you've said. And it was. Because I finally had surrendered to the fact that I didn't need to try to figure this thing out. I just needed to believe that she believed at that point, and that was good. We got on our knees, she took out the book, and she opened up to the third step prayer, and right then and there, we said the prayer together, and there was two other people in the room. And she told me, she said, you know what, I want you to look out the window and I want you to realize something. When you are done with this third step prayer, the way you look at that outside again is going to be completely different because of what's going to go on in your insides. Didn't make sense then, but it makes sense today. She took me through my four step. It was kind of interesting. I'm a good alcoholic girl, and I still had one little minor detail I forgot to tell her about, which was the guy in Fort Myers who was kind of married, and I was going to go visit him one weekend, and I was leaving her house, and she said, I don't know where you're going, right, you know, as sponsors, but wherever you're going, I hope you don't put your sobriety in jeopardy. And maybe it's time you get clean with your life. And of course, oh, I'm fine. I drive onto I-4, and before I hit 75, it occurs to me that I'm playing Russian roulette with my life yet again. I pulled over, got on my knees, and I said, God, please keep me on the path. And I turned my car around, and I went back to her house, and I said, I'm ready to get busy. And, you know, I sat at her kitchen table many, many nights finishing my fourth step. And I did a dry run with the priest for my fifth step. I thought there were some things that I needed to try out on him first. And if he didn't, like, freak out, maybe I would share it with her. And come to find out, this guy was an AA. Jeez. Like he hadn't heard that crap before, right? So, you know, here I am, still trying to work the system. You know, 6 and 7 just kind of almost came and went. I don't want to say it in a very disarming way, but, you know, 2 paragraphs, read the chapters. Please render me white as snow. Not that he did. Please, God, take away these defects, replace them with what you would have me be. And for a while, you know, I kind of thought I was doing all right. You know, until year 8 or 7. I started making my amends. So I had my list ready. Now, there's a great story with this one, of course. It goes back to my mother. No mother issues here. And when I first moved into their house, I was there about a week. And she said, by the way, I know you got some step work to do. And I have this book, and it was a little black book, of all the money you've ever borrowed from us and never paid us back. And you will make us the first on your list. Well, I open up this book, a little Catholic prayer card falls out. Gee whiz. And she had the date, the reason why, and the amount of all my money that I borrowed, I was just stealing from them, for about 3 years. And I find that amusing because, you know, I thought I was going to kind of skip through that one. I really don't know how much I owe my parents. Yeah, well, now I do. You know, I was able to pay them back, and I did it quick because there was something about doing those ninth step amends that started freeing me from me and freeing me from you. And boy, howdy, what a relief. I've got to tell you that there was one person left on that amends list that I finally did. I couldn't find them. I eventually found them about 8 months ago. I called them up and I told them what my purpose of the phone call was for. I told them what I was doing today in my life and the reason why I couldn't find them. I mean, we didn't have that much technology back in the 80s. There was no Googling people back then. And when I did call this person's family, I was told to, you know, take a hike in a deep river with some boots on. So it was amazing that if you stay around here long enough, that first list that you had can be completed. And what a relief. You know, my 10th step is where I find my daily reprieve and I find life. And, you know, I have found out that if I don't work that thing, the 10th step, on a continuous basis, doo-doo piles up, as my old sponsor would say. Or as I say, shit piles up. And It was about 5 years ago. My stuff started piling up. There were some things I really hadn't looked at. And, you know, I almost put my marriage in jeopardy. And I look at that today as what a tragedy that would have been. But, you know, through all those moments of growing up and making mistakes and trying to do this thing a day at a time, I'm grateful that I am just given a day at a time. You know, sober, I've made some pretty incredible mistakes. But I've been granted grace through God's help and new people to just keep moving the course. My 11th step is something that continues to grow. You know, I think about that, and I think about my sponsor who's just passed. And she was a proponent on connecting to that God in your life. You know, she had a way of using swear words with praying. That was just so unique. Her, one of her favorite words was the F word. And she would be, "He's so effing good, isn't he?" And I'd be like, "Amen." You know, like, a little revival going on here. But yes, she liked swearing with prayers. And I love that today, because sometimes as I'm in my bathroom in the morning connecting to a God of my understanding and I talk to him out loud, I laugh because sometimes I hear a voice in my head. And, you know, for me, the gift is giving it back. And that's what 12th step is about. You know, I cannot give to you what I don't know. And what I do know today is that the answers are in the book. My opinion doesn't count. And the book is where I have found the message and where I've learned to live differently. You know, I'm grateful for the family I have in my life today. I met a great guy, and, you know, I walked down the aisle. Actually, I was pulled by my father down the aisle. You know, finally. And I have two great stepkids. I'm a nana. And I'm not a grandmother, I'm a nana. And because I'm too young to be a grandmother. And, you know, I get to work today. I get to give to others today. And I've got to share a story with you. You know, this death has been a real kick in the pants for me. I knew I loved people. But I've learned that sometimes God puts certain people in your path that really hit you at that heart level. And I was really honored to walk with Betty Davis. And it was a quick go-down-the-hill deal. You know, she called me one day and said, "You need to come to my house." And she told me she was diagnosed with cancer. And her only concern at that point was my Tuesday night meetings. And I said, "Don't worry, we've got you covered." Because in AA, that's what we do. We cover each other. We help each other out when we need to. And the night we got the phone call that Betty had passed, I hadn't seen her that day. And there was a lot of guilt inside of me. And they said, "Come see her." I was her medical her surrogate. And so we drove up there, my husband and I, at 11 o'clock at night, and there laid my sponsor on her bed, and she looked really peaceful. And I leaned over and I kissed her on her lips and I said, "Oh, Betty, I love you." And Betty always would tell people, whether you spoke with her on the phone or face to face, go with God. And she said that religiously every time. And I looked at my husband after we had been there for about, I don't know, 45 minutes, and I said, "It's time to pray." And this is where I learned how to do that in AA. You have taught me how to pray. You've taught me how to be there for those situations that I thought were impossible. You've taught me how to be a sister to a sister, a friend to a friend, a mom to stepchildren, a wife. And you've taught me how to be a good sponsee to a sponsor who is in need. And so we stood there and we held her hands and we held each other's hands and we said the Our Father with her. And so tonight, as I stand here, I know she is with me and us. She's probably sitting in her chair. Sorry. That's always where she sat. And she would be doing her perpetual head bob. And I am grateful for the journey that she allowed me to share with her. And I am grateful for the journey you've allowed me to share with you. And I thank you for allowing me to be here tonight.